Everyone, I'm Gary Nall. In this segment of our program, we will talk about something that affects virtually everyone, our mental well-being, but from a different perspective. We're going to begin by talking about the experiences of one individual who will remain anonymous, and her child was a psychiatric victim. She's an activist. She's worked with psychiatrists and workers in the field to try to support the idea that not every label is real, and therefore dig deeper than what the press and the mainstream medical community has suggested are the so-called real causes of the conditions. Let's go over and say hello to her now. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, thank you. Glad to speak with you.
Why don't you just take some time and explain your story. I don't want to interrupt because you're more than competent to give us an entire background of what the important and salient points are.
Okay, yeah, I'll make this fairly brief. My husband and I have been married a long time. We have three boys that are now 21, 17, and 15. We no longer live in the community where all this took place. We decided to move away. And our three boys, the community that we lived in had a very high consumption rate of Ritalin. In fact, it had the highest consumption rate in the state that we lived in. And that was because a doctor that operated an ADHD clinic, who said he had it himself, was a it was really the ADD epicenter. All three of my boys, I tell people, were considered at risk for this disorder, which is not unusual today because we're literally at epidemic proportions in the United States. This is a uniquely American phenomenon. What happened in our situation was when my middle son went off to kindergarten, at the end of his kindergarten year, his teacher approached us and said that he wasn't reading as well as his classmates, that he wasn't working to his potential, that he seemed very distractible and not unruly or necessarily rambunctious, but he just wasn't doing very well. And she suggested that we seek out the an ADD diagnosis. She was very explicit. She didn't really mention the medication, but she said, I think this is what your son has. So we started getting information. We got some from the school district, which we later found out was supplied to the district through a certain pharmaceutical company, which I thought was very interesting. And we read all that, and it definitely said that, that ADHD is due to a neurochemical imbalance. And so we just kind of started kicking this around and mulling it over, and my son went on to first grade and still didn't do real well, still wasn't very interested in school. Had a, I think, a fairly regimented teacher that was that really wanted the children to buckle down and study in first grade, which is okay to a point, but she was kind of a battle axe teacher. I went on to second grade, and he did okay. Still not real interested in school in the academics of it. Went on to third grade and really started falling behind. And so I, you know, went to the pediatrician, and we went through the whole, jumped through a lot of hoops and did all the evaluations. And, you know, we evaluated him and the teacher and the pediatrician. It's really a three-pronged diagnosis. And he certainly fit what I call the ADD profile. Didn't stay on task. There's, you know, a certain criteria that if you meet these criteria, you've got the disorder. And so we went ahead and, not unwillingly, but very, reluctantly, put him on the medication, on Ritalin, and it was about 20 milligrams a day. And it was just in the morning because that's when the kids did most of the academic work. People ask me now, did it help? I honestly don't know, because we didn't give it to them on the weekends, although a lot of people do, because and doctors say that the kids are learning, you know, 365 days a year. And so I never really observed him on the medication, although I did observe him off the medication, and unfortunately he had some very severe adverse drug reactions. He had cardiac arrhythmia and very bad chest pain several times. So that went on through third and fourth grade. Then into fifth grade, things academically really started falling apart, so it was suggested by a teacher to put him on dexedrine. Well, that lasted for 3 weeks, because it kept him up till 1 o'clock every morning. And it kept me up too, trying to get him to go to sleep. Just wasn't tired. And this was from a morning dose of the medication. So I thought this was pretty powerful stuff. Well, then, I started talking to a lot of parents, and my skepticism really started to surface about this, because we would be at a soccer game or at some sort of a cocktail party, and it was really the talk of the town. And I thought, something seemed not right. It seemed very wrong. And then I really started looking into this, and this was back in 1995, 96. And our book, very good book, came out, The Myth of the ADD Child by Dr. Thomas Armstrong. And there were certain articles that were coming out in magazines and newspapers. I started reading some things by Dr. Peter Bragan, who's written Talking Back to Ritalin, Toxic Psychiatry, The War Against Children. I saw a name, Dr. Larry Diller, coming up. But on the flip side, I started reading other articles that I consider to be very pro-diagnosis, pro-medication. And eventually, after the dexedrine experience, I really started figuring that it was an issue of underachievement, underperformance. And I could see very, very readily with all of my boys. My oldest son, the district approached us also, telling us that they would really encourage an evaluation, because he wasn't doing well all through middle school when my other son was still in elementary school. Well, then when my other son hit ninth grade, he took off. He finally buckled down and started studying. He saw some relevance to what he was learning. It suddenly became more meaningful and purposeful, and he did very well in high school, 9th through 12th grade. He graduated with honors, went on to be the secretary of the National Honor Society at his school, and is now in an engineering major at a very good four-year college. And so my middle son is just, he's doing okay. He hasn't taken off academically my other son did.
Hold on. Why should he?
Why should he?
Why in the hell should your sons, what right do you or any other parents say, you're all equal, go out there, and if you don't, you're mentally disordered, I'm going to put you on Ritalin?
Well,
what right does any parent have to demand of one son to equal another?
Well, it wasn't that I was demanding it, and I'm still not. I'm just saying that I've accepted their differences.
Now you do.
Definitely.
But what about the other 7 million kids whose parents haven't yet got around to that?
Well, the only problem is, I think you've got to be very, very careful about where your information is coming from. And I tend to tell parents that there's many, many people that are very, very well-intentioned, that have been very miseducated, misinformed, I think basically lied to about what not just ADHD is, but that comes under the whole umbrella of learning disabilities. Parents are told all kinds of things by different healthcare professionals, counselors, social workers, psychologists, occupational therapists about what these disorders are. And it really boils down to what your ideology is. If you come from a very, you know, biopsychiatric point of view or a more, you know, psychosocial point of view, whether you look at this strictly as a neurochemical imbalance or if you tend to look at the environmental influence that this has on the child's normal human growth and development. Much of the time, it's not taken into account the sex differences between boys and girls, the growth rate. It's a gross generalization, but I think it's true that boys tend to grow up later. There's not anything wrong with them. It's just that they're in a system, in an education system, both public and private, that demand the same of boys what girls can do, and they will get there. They're slower to potty train normally. And what I'm finding is that oftentimes people that I talk to is they've had a girl that does well, you know, even starting in preschool, she does well. She sits down, she'll sit and do. And then here comes the boy, a little more, not oftentimes, not a lot more rambunctious, not necessarily off the wall, but he just doesn't get with it. So, okay, well, then they start looking at, well, we've got a girl. Oh, my gosh, we've got a boy. Look at him. He's going to fall further and further behind. This is often what they're told by healthcare professionals. And it's, is he falling further and further behind? Well, it depends on the tasks that you're having him complete. You've got to look at, is it meaningful? Is it purposeful for both boys and girls? Do they really have an interest in what they're doing? And when do they want to do it? I mean, we're having preschoolers now labeled as young as 2 years old with ADHD and bipolar.
There's another part to this that I think must be examined, and that is I'm holding the parents particularly responsible for this. Excuse me, and that is, if you took almost any child from the Orient today, they would, across the board, be labeled as ADD or ADHD. They are not, for the most part, outgoing. They've been conditioned to be more introspective, holding their emotions intact. And that would be considered a shyness disorder. So they would be shy, and they'd be psychiatrically labeled and given a drug. And since there's no specific drug for shyness, they'd be given one of the common drugs. It never occurs to anyone that what's wrong with just being. We hate the idea in our society, especially baby boomers, of being without purpose. We're always supposed to have a purpose, a goal, motivation to get there, discipline to create the motivation, and a passion to fuel it all, a higher ideal, success, competition. And in the process of doing that, we frequently lose our sense of identity. Did it ever occur to any adults that when their kids take a careful look at what they become themselves, that they may not want to duplicate or emulate the parents, the high stress levels, the high judgmentalness, the lack of quality of life, the lack of unconditional love, the peace of mind, the inability to sit still and feel comfortable? And so kids say, I'm just going to kind of hang out in the moment. And we think, no, you can't. You've got to get in there. You've got to achieve. You've got to prove yourself. You're up against competition. There's a shortage of everything. And then we put them in a condition where they can't win and can only be labeled. Does that ever occur to you?
To me?
Yeah, you.
Well, it does now. But back then, I really truly believed that from what I was getting from many different people, I really felt that if we didn't do, you've got to understand that I have flip-flopped so totally that, you know, back when I had my son labeled and, you know, identified, which is to me very harsh language anymore, to say that you're going to have your child identified, whoa, that is a very, very strong statement. People don't realize that. But I really felt that if I didn't do what I did, that he would not, you know, succeed in life. That I was told it's really used now as what I tend to tell people as a preventative diagnosis, because parents are told that, you know, your child is at risk for failure. Nobody wants their child to fail. I didn't want my child to fail. He's not going to fail now. I mean, because he's got some very good, he's a very decent person. All three of the boys are, because I've let them I backed off a lot. I've given them a lot of space. And that's what these kids need more, rather than, you know, clamping down on the children and intervening. We've got to look at the numbers of children that are requiring intervention. Now, that's much different than prevention. Those are two very different concepts.
But there's a different, there's something here that I would ask you to examine, and that is, how many kids who are normal to themselves, who are not looking to succeed like you or anyone else, who don't need to prove themselves through their success, which is just another form of insecurity, are happy. And we can't stand the idea that their principles, their values, their views are not coalescing with ours. So we then make it a disorder, whether the school teacher or sociologist, the parent, that what's wrong with you? Why aren't you more motivated? Why aren't you doing with this? Why aren't you, you're not up and you're not going to get ahead. Maybe the kid just doesn't want to. But we've made not wanting to be like everyone else a disorder. So we put people in a position to be diagnosed, and the diagnosis is so broad-based, every child on the planet could be pathologized tomorrow if they were interviewed. Depending upon the town, the person, the school district, they could be 100% or they could be less, depending upon if they got cat on that web. And does it ever occur to people that it's just the unmitigated greed of the pharmaceutical companies like the makers of Ritalin and Prozac and Luvox and some of the others that is causing us to suddenly look at everyone not as a human being with unique and gifted skills? Do you think every artist, every pianist, every poet, every dancer, every composer would be out there competing to win, competing to succeed, trying to get into the best schools when many of them are very, very inner-driven but shy and quiet and don't fit in anywhere and weren't meant to, but that's normal for them, but it's not for society. And suddenly if we allowed them no longer to be unique, where would we be when all of our artists and all of our creative people are on Prozac or on Ritalin?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it's those very programs that artistic programs, art classes, music classes, are being done away with, and the bulk of the money is being channeled towards, special education, and the schools are literally being turned into mental health centers, and I find this frightening. Now, no doubt that a lot of children are experiencing behavioral and emotional problems, but we have to look at this as a systemic problem.
Well, no, I disagree completely. Why don't you try looking at it as a moral issue or an interpersonal issue or a social dynamic or familial issue instead of a systemic issue? Because that still falls into the idea that every kid's a disease.
Because the problem is within the school system. There are schools out there that do not even have playgrounds anymore. We've got schools out there that no longer allow recess. So the problem is, what you've got is, in a community, is you could have, you know, child after child after child being, you know, identified. And that is a systemic problem. It's no longer an individual problem. I understand what you're saying, that let the children be individuals.
Baby boomers are the disease.
Yeah.
Our generation quite simply has to fade away until there's actually decency. Our generation has done the worst damn job in history of raising kids. We literally have ruined an entire generation of kids' lives. Why do you think I wrote a book on this called The Baby Boomers Guide to Getting Around Second Time Around. I was so concerned with the mistakes in our arrogance, our elitism, our anger at what we cannot control, our inability to cope with our own inner demons, our own insecurity, and our own denial process, and all this is end up being sopped up or forced upon the children as if somehow their success redeems our inner demon. We bask in what they achieve. So every parent is so proud, whether it's a little league. You ever go around any of those little leagues? My God, no kid should have to be playing little league, because if you ever watch, the parents are really the ones playing. They're the ones competing. They're the ones who have the ego on the sideline, yelling and screaming at their kids and high-fiving when they hit a ball and looking at them scornfully like you're no longer lovable and you're a disappointment and you let me down. If they miss it, the poor kid is traumatized by all this. Mm-hmm. You know, close down the suburbs. Lock up the damn worthless place. Close it down, ban Little League, and let the kids rule for a while, because the parents have sure as hell not done any kind of worthwhile job.
Right. Well, you've got to look at it, too, just the way we've literally been conditioned or brainwashed into thinking this way.
You know what would be a good idea? Have you ever... There's a place in New York City. It's at 89th and Riverside Drive, and I walk around there because I live on the Upper West Side, where I'm broadcasting from. And there's always teenagers and young kids over there, and I go over and I talk, and I ask them, I said, what's on your mind? What are the issues that you feel about? And I just sit back and listen. I don't correct them, don't challenge them, I just listen.
Yeah.
And you know what's interesting?
What?
Is at the end of an evening, they'll come over and say, hey, man, you know, no adult ever listens to us. They're always trying to correct us, you know, or make us feel like we're stupid, and we appreciate it. And so I keep going back, and other kids, and I've talked with hundreds of kids, and you know what's frightening is that their parents who live up and down Riverside Drive, the lawyers, the academics, the doctors, and, you know, the old baby boomers, they never listen to them. They may think they do, but these kids are telling us they don't. And that they feel that they're always on display and they're always under the gun. And they're doing a lot of things out of rebellion. They're doing things just out of anger. And one kid told me that his best friend, 2 weeks before that, had committed suicide. And I said, why do you think he committed suicide? He said he hated his parents. And the only way he could get their attention was to kill himself.
Well, see, that's just it. It's our, you know, the kids, they don't lack the attention. They lack our attention. Now, I can tell you honestly, though, I wasn't, you know, overindulgent. I mean, there's a fine line between, you know, neglecting and overindulgence. And I wasn't one of the parents that, I mean, my kids have been on some teams, but I didn't, you know, have them signed up. I never felt that they were a real, you know, reflection of my, of what I wanted them to be.
Well, good for you, because you're in the minority, and I appreciate you sharing your views. We're out of time for this program. I want to thank you very much for being on and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Nall, and that concludes another program. We're coming back to share more, though.